When someone is jailed in Iran for something they drew or something they wrote, there's often a backstory that involves complicated political rivalries in the country. Shahram Rafizadeh knows very well how these things can play out. He's an Iranian writer who shined a light on the dark side of Iranian politics. The World's Matthew Bell met Rafizadeh in Toronto recently, where he lives and continues to write.
Shahram Rafizadeh fell in love with language as a kid in Iran. He's no language whiz, though. He's been living in Canada for about 8 years now, and he apologizes for not being able to speak English. "My kids all speak English perfectly," he says, smiling and shaking his head of curly black hair. Rafizadeh looks every bit the intellectual, glasses, leather jacket, cigarette. It's Persian poetry that moves him. As a child, he would wake up early and recite poems out loud, annoying his siblings. He's 44 now, and his poems usually have a political edge. One of the more recent ones, he tells me, is a harsh critique of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and another is a melancholy one about not being able to go home.
Chamedan-ha u kafsh-ha baz migardand. Havapeyma-ha u tabidi-ha.
When anti-government protests erupted in the Arab world in 2011, Rafizadeh wrote about the spring of freedom that had yet to arrive in Iran. Back in the 1990s, he made a name for himself in Iran as a newspaper reporter covering human rights. But at heart, he's always been a poet. If you want to write poetry in Iran, you really have to write about politics, Rafizadeh says. That's the reality. In Iran, Rafizadeh says, the government intrudes into your personal life no matter who you are. That's why, after the murders started happening, he says he decided to infuse his poems with politics. The murders he's talking about were a series of political assassinations in Iran that began in 1998. One of the first victims was a well-known poet named Mohammad Mokhtari. He was also Rafizadeh's mentor. Mokhtari was my friend, he says. Other intellectuals were killed too. Rafizadeh says the Iranian regime was murdering innocent people just because they dared to call for political change and reform. He managed to shine a light on the killings with his writings for a time, but eventually Rafizadeh was arrested. I spent 86 days in a cell the size of a closet, Rafizadeh says, and I was tortured. After he was released, pending trial, he says, authorities threatened to harm his children if he didn't make statements saying he was treated well in prison and that his past writings were false. He did what they told him to do, but Rafizadeh says he's confident the Iranian public knew the truth. Other journalists besides me, he says, wrote about the human rights situation in Iran, and we did have an impact. Rafizadeh felt, though, that he had no choice but to leave the country. The courts sentenced him to 20 lashes and 9 months in prison. He escaped in 2005 and later got asylum in Canada. Nowadays, he works as a journalist for Radio Farda. That's the U.S. government-funded Farsi language station. Rafizadeh also writes for a politics website called Iran Wire. From Toronto, he's still very wrapped up in what's playing out back home in Iran. Rafizadeh says a couple of things give him hope. First, the nuclear deal Iran reached with the U.S. He says it should take pressure off middle-class Iranians who've suffered under sanctions. And second, the electoral system. When people voted for the moderates and reformists in the recent parliamentary election, Rafizadeh says that was an act of civic resistance against the supreme leader and the hardliners. And that, he adds, is meaningful. For The World, Matthew Bell, Toronto.
Matthew played a bit of Shahram reading his poem, The Spring of Freedom, but the entire poem is really powerful. We have the full recording up on our Facebook page, along with an English translation so you can follow along. Just look for PRI's The World. We first read about Shahram Rafizadeh in a new book called Children of Paradise. It's a recent political history of Iran told through the personal stories of some incredible people. Laura Secor is the author. Her book covers a period going back to the 1990s. That's when Iran's reformists rose to prominence. But then came the crackdown.
Well, the reformists, when they came into power in 1997, they had a lot of popular support behind them. They came in with a mandate, really, to open up the civil society space in Iran, which meant really making room for civic actors outside the political sphere, newspapers, even intellectuals and civil society activists, people who were running little NGOs that were trying to improve conditions of life in Iran. So the scene was really flooded with young people who were very enthusiastic about taking part in building a better future in Iran. But as it happened, there is in Iran what you might call a deep state, an apparatus of repression and an apparatus of intelligence that is not answerable entirely to the elected government. So what happened in the late 90s and early 2000s was a real battle for the soul of the country between the elected government of Mohammad Khatami, which was dominated by reformists, and the security apparatus, which includes the Revolutionary Guards and the judiciary and the intelligence apparatus. And in the end, the tragedy of those years was that by the end of Khatami's second term, a lot of Iranians were disillusioned. They felt that they had brought these people into power, but that they weren't able to be very effective because even when their own people, their own supporters, were being harassed or imprisoned or endangered by the security apparatus, the reformists were not able to effectively confront that deep state.
In your book, you tell the story, a really riveting story, of Asya Amini, a woman whose own work and activism kind of tracks the rise and fall of the reformist movement through the 90s and 2000s. She's a journalist, became an activist for women's rights, campaigned against the stoning of girls and women accused of infidelity. Why did she take up this cause?
You know, one of the reasons that I took up her story was that her story actually continues past the end of the Khatami period. So we're now into Ahmadinejad when
right.
we have a pretty serious crackdown on all of the forms of civic activity that had been let loose under Khatami. But Asya and the women's movement remained very active through this period. And that was what interested me, and particularly in her story, because she was taking up a particularly dangerous cause in pursuing stoning, and she was doing it at a time when there was very, very little room and no support within the system. So she was a journalist. She was somebody who, one of the other reasons I liked her story was that it's a very recognizable story. She grows up in the north of Iran with no sense that there are limitations on her, on what she can do in the world as a woman.
Hers is a pretty middle class and a progressive family, we could say.
Yeah. And her father was a very progressive man in the sense that he let her go and live on her own, well, with roommates, but as an independent young woman in Mashhad when she was, you know, only maybe 18, 19 years old. And she had a lot of confidence that came from that upbringing. She comes to Tehran and she becomes a journalist, a very ambitious young journalist. She gets a lot of great jobs that put her into positions of power over men who are older than her. She gets a lot of editorships and she's extremely hardworking and enterprising as a reporter. It's also a career that anybody in the world who's worked in the media can recognize. And she, at one point, under Khatami, as the media starts to flower, there's a publication that starts up that specifically focuses on women. And she, through a network of contacts through that publication, she starts working on a website of women's news, and she comes across a little local story that is about a young woman who was executed for crimes against chastity in a small town in the province of her birth. And she becomes curious about this story. She goes to pursue it. And what she finds out is that this girl was really only 16 years old when she was executed, that she had been orphaned and raped and forced into prostitution, and that this was really a story of a person without resources who was under the coercive power of a rapist, and that she had been executed for this. This story really begins to haunt Asya, and she becomes obsessed with the problem of juvenile execution in Iran. And that's not only about women, but a lot of the people she tracks are women.
I mean, it's a really, really horrifying kind of episodes that Asya gets herself into. I mean, the fight she ends up engaged in, really, the way you tell the story, is against the stoning and kind of standing up for women, but it's also against the judges in some of these remote areas of Iran who are defying a national ban on stoning. I mean,
that's right.
How common is it that judges in Iran point to Sharia law and say that's higher than the highest authority in the government in Tehran?
Well, that's the thing that she really uncovers in her work, because stoning had been – there was a moratorium on stoning declared by the highest justice in the land. And she was finding in the provinces that they were continuing to carry out stoning sentences. And the reasoning behind that was that there are contradictory clauses in the Constitution and in the Penal Code, one of which says that judges should answer to statutory law, which is, you know, the legislation as passed by Parliament. Mm. And there was another one that said that in the case – that there is no applicable statutory law, judges may then appeal to scripture or relevant fatwas. So these judges, some of the hardest line judges, believed that they were not answerable to the Chief Justice or to statutory law. They believed that they could find their answers really in relevant fatwas, meaning the rulings of Ayatollahs, or within the holy texts. So this is actually, from what I understand, a very live battle within the Iranian judiciary. There are those judges who believe that they are answerable to the law of the land, and there are those who believe they're a law unto themselves.
Isn't that judicial prerogative, if we can call it that, a huge obstacle if other parts of Iranian society are pushing for democracy?
Absolutely. And that is a conclusion that a lot of the reformist intellectuals came to by the end of the Ahmadinejad period, that really you can fight for rights and freedoms in the political space all you like, but if there is not judicial protection of them, that is a fundamental problem, and that really the fundamental fight for reform in Iran is going to have to be a battle with the judiciary.
So there's no shortage of Iranians, writers, activists who seem to have faith in the Iranian political system still. But what about you, Laura? Do you look at the recent election in Iran and see the vote for moderate and reformist candidates as a reason to be hopeful?
I see the behavior of the Iranian electorate as a reason to be hopeful. The system is it's a very unusual system. It's totally unique in the world. And for that reason, it's very hard to sort of to predict its outcomes. The fact that there has been from the very beginning this fight to find a democratic representative space within what is essentially a theocratic system, it's a real tribute to the people of that country and the civic spirit of that country. That's the thing that I kept returning to when I was working on this book, is just this question of why these people continue not just to fight, but to look for space in a system that has not obviously afforded them space. This last election was interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One, you know, I think that the reformists after 2009, the real sort of visionary part of the reformist movement, had been pretty effectively and brutally pushed down. But under Rouhani, there has been a resurgence of at least some part of that agenda and a resurgence of the voters, which strikes me as interesting because in the past when I went to Iran, I had a sense that the fight to get people to vote for lesser evils was something that really, in some ways, stymied the reform movement. They needed to get people out there to vote, not because they really thought that there was a candidate in the race who could totally execute their vision, but because there were still stakes in these elections of other kinds. And this last election was a real triumph of strategic voting. The reformists got a message out to the electorate that was essentially, vote for this list of candidates, not because you like or have ever even heard of the people on this list, but because this is our best strategy for blocking the hardline agenda that's coming from the ultra hardline right. And that they got people to come out and vote for that list, which did include a lot of total unknowns and also people who this particular part of the electorate has no love for. But people came out and did it as a strategic move, which said to me, that sense of where the space is to intervene in political life in Iran is, you know, it's still contested. It's still evolving. There's still some, you know, some sense that ordinary people have a right to and have some hope for finding space in the system.
Do you think the conservatives, the hardliners, have created in some clever way a space where the reformists can operate, but they can contain them?
That's my concern. Yeah, I think that there is, yeah, at the moment, To be clear-eyed here, the regime has consolidated toward its center. The sort of dominating faction right now in politics is President Rouhani's faction. This comes out of the center-right, and it's kind of an interesting It's an interesting moment because, you know, under Ahmadinejad, you had a real swing to the hardline right. And before him, under Khatami, that was a swing out to the reformist left. Now we've come into the center. Those two poles really have become so antagonistic toward one another that it was a zero-sum game between them. So now it makes sense, in a way, to bring the system toward the center, where you have some buy-in from the moderate part of the reformist wing and some buy-in from the moderate part of the conservative wing. And the concern is that this will stabilize the regime without actually producing substantial reform, and that you get these reformist voters now willing again to participate, which gives a sense of legitimacy to the proceedings. And if this center faction can keep them appeased, it also becomes a source of strength for the centrists. So yes, there's some concern that for the reformists to stay engaged in the system as it is, they have to really ratchet down their expectations and their demands, which may, you know, in the end, fundamentally compromise their identity and make it even less likely for them to achieve their goals. The flip side of that I hear from others is that, well, maybe it's a pragmatic choice to, for the moment, ratchet down those expectations and goals, and once there is a more powerful moderate faction, there can be a more incremental movement in a reformist direction. I think that really is a speculative position, though. It remains to be seen.
Laura Sikor, the author of Children of Paradise. Laura, thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me.